Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Long chapter today. Long chapter. In fact, I'm only reading half of the chapter, and even that is long. The chapter went for 36 pages or something like that. So we're doing half of that. It's still going to take us a little while, so let's get stuck in. First, we'll talk about chapter 6, part 2. Is the plot progressing at all? And how do you feel about the pace of this book? Just kind of feel like we're just kind of floundering around in this prison. And what was your favourite line of the chapter? I play Apex Legends. Says I am Norwegian. I played Apex Legends, for a couple of weeks until the children got too good. I've never been able to aim very well on consoles, but I'm sure I'd smoke them if I had a better PC. Yep. So I originally got it on PlayStation. This is way off topic, but this is what we were talking about yesterday. And tried it out, and I was like, oh, this is a cool game, but I'm the same. I couldn't really aim on the console very well. But seeing as a free game, I then downloaded it on the PC, because I also got a PC, and played it on there. And so I played it on the PC. It's a lot of fun. It's a very addictive game, because it's one of those games where it's always, one more. Oh, that one doesn't count. We'll do one more. And then you end up doing 10 one mores, and then you've played it for 2.5 hours when you just wanted to quickly have a little break and, you know, play one round. You never end up playing just one round. That's the problem. It's a bit too addictive. I think I might have to delete the game or something, because I keep wasting more hours than I intended to, which is a bit of a problem. So I'm all for a little bit of gaming here and there. Same as watching a bit of telly, watch a movie here or there, a bit of entertainment. But it's when you get kind of stuck and I think, oh, I should stop playing now. And then an hour later, I'm like, oh, I really should stop playing now. Just one more, though. And it's that kind of icky feeling of like, I'm doing something that I don't want to do. I feel like I'm sucked into this game. So that's been happening this week, actually, a few times. I've been playing that game. They released like a new update to it. And since that new update, I've been just playing it a lot. It's not cool. But what do you do? Yeah, maybe just be more disciplined. Because it sucks to have to delete a game that I'm actually enjoying playing, but at the same time, I don't like how many hours I've wasted on it over the last week or so. Anywho, let's get back on topic here. There are moments of the book where something shines through, especially when Cummings veers into getting snippy about government and authority. I wish there was more focus on the absurdity, but Cummings takes it all in such stride that it almost feels like I'm reading an exposé by someone that doesn't care all that much. Sounds like some of the women are in the prison having it really rough. Is the plot progressing at all, and how do you feel about the pace? I think Cummings is just going to continue throwing experiences at us until the end, except he'll sometimes say on day 10 or in the third week or and then towards the end, etc. Still, we're already halfway done and some parts are pretty fun. Waraka Akbar said, we haven't seen your name around for a little bit. Waraka Akbar, welcome back. Yeah, I am enjoying the descriptions and the scenes, but this book could really have used some structure. I agree that in general, Cummings comes across too often as blasé and sarcastic, but his description of the women's plight felt deeply sympathetic. I don't have much of a problem with his sarcasm and his blasé-ness. I think it's kind of an interesting lens to look at the situation through. It's like, how did he arrive at that? And he's written this as an account looking back over that time and seems to be doing it with quite a bit of good humour, which I find interesting. I think more my problem is just structure-wise. Structurally, the book, it doesn't seem to have a direction, you know, which is fine, but it doesn't feel like he's trying to survive in this hellhole. He doesn't feel like he's trying to escape. He doesn't feel like there's any real progression, which might be a realistic account of what happens. Maybe that's all that is. It's just sort of a general existence there for the time being, and then life moves on to the next phase if you're lucky and you manage to get out of the prison. I don't know. It just feels... it feels a bit directionless, this book, so far, doesn't it? That's been my problem with it, at least. Now, what was I saying? Other things to be said in life. Oh, that's it, actually. That's all the conversation about this chapter. It's short and sweet. I suppose we'll get on and keep reading then, because it is a long chapter. Chapter 7, An Approach to the Delectable Mountains. Sunday, says Mr. Pound with infinite penetration, is a dreadful day. Monday is much pleasanter. Then let us muse a little space upon fond nature's morbid grace. It is a great and distinct pleasure to have penetrated and arrived upon the outside of La Damanche. We may now, nature's morbid grace being a topic whereof the reader has already heard much and will necessarily hear more, turn to the much pleasanter, the fact, Monday aspect of La Ferte, by which I mean Le Nouveau, whose arrivals and reactions constituted the actual kinetic aspect of our otherwise merely real non-existence. Let us tighten our belts. Everyone used to tighten his belt at least twice a day at La Ferte, but for another reason, to follow and keep track of his surely shrinking anatomy. Seize our staffs into our hands and continue the ascent begun with the first pages of the story. One day I found myself expecting La Soupe, number one, with something like avidity. My appetite faded, however, upon perceiving a vision en route of to the empty place at my left. It slightly resembled a tall youth, not more than 16 or 17 years old, having flaxen hair, a face whose whiteness I have never seen equalled, and an expression of intense starvation, which might have been well enough in a human being, but was somewhat unnecessarily uncanny in a ghost. The ghost, floating and slenderly, made for the place beside me, seated himself suddenly and gently like a morsel of white wind, and regarded the wall before him. La Soupe arrived. He obtained a plate after some protest on the part of certain members of our table, to whom the advent of a newcomer meant only that everyone would get less for lunch. And after gazing at his portion for a second in apparent wonderment at its size, caused it gently and suddenly to disappear. I was no sluggard as a rule, but found myself outclassed by minutes, which, said I to myself, is not to be worried over, since 'tis sheer vanity to compete with the supernatural. But even as I lugged the last spoonful of lukewarm, greasy water to my lips, this ghost turned to me for all the world as if I too were a ghost, and remarked softly, "Will you lend me 10 cents? I am going to buy tobacco at the canteen." One has no business crossing a spirit, I thought, and produced the sum cheerfully, which sum disappeared. The ghost arose slenderly and soundlessly, and I was left with emptiness beside me. Later I discovered that this ghost was called Pete. Pete was a Hollander, and therefore found firm and staunch friends in Harry, John of the Bathhouse, and the other Hollanders. In 3 days Pete discarded the immateriality which had constituted the exquisite definiteness of his advent, and donned the garb of flesh and blood. This change was due equally to the soup and the canteen, and to the finding of friends, for Pete had been in solitary confinement for 3 months, and had had nothing to eat but bread and water during that time, having been told by the jailers, as he informed us without a trace of bitterness, that they would shorten his sentence provided he did not partake of la soupe during his incarceration. That is to say, le gouvernement français had a little joke at Pete's expense. Also, he had known nobody during that time but the 5 fingers which deposited said bread and water with conscientious regularity on the ground beside him. Being a Hollander, neither of these things killed him. On the contrary, he merely turned into a ghost, thereby fooling the excellent French government within an inch of its foolable life. He was a very excellent friend of ours. I refer, as usual, to B and myself, and from the day of his arrival until the day of his departure, to Pressing, along with B and 3 others, I never ceased to like and to admire him. He was naturally sensitive, extremely the antithesis of coarse, which refined somehow does not imply, had not in the least suffered from a good, as we say, education, and possessed an at once frank and unobstreperous personality. Very little that had happened to Pete's physique had escaped Pete's mind. This mind of his quietly and firmly had expanded in proportion as its owner's trousers had become too big around the waist, altogether not so extraordinary as was the fact that after being physically transformed, as I have never seen a human being transformed by food and friends, Pete thought and acted with exactly the same quietness and firmness as before. He was a rare spirit, and I salute him wherever he is. Mexicu was a good friend of Pete's, as he was of ours. He had been introduced to us by a man we called One-Eyed David, who was married and had a wife downstairs, with which wife he was allowed to live all day, being conducted to and from her society by a planton. He spoke Spanish well and French passably, had black hair, bright Jewish eyes, a dead fish expression, and both amiable and courteous disposition. One-Eyed David, as it was pronounced, of course, had been in prison at Noyon during the German occupation, which he described fully and without hyperbole, stating that no one could have been more considerate or just than the commander of the invading troops. David had seen with his own eyes a French girl extend an apple to one of the common soldiers as the German army entered the outskirts of the city. "Take it," she said, "you are tired." "Madame," answered the German soldier in French, "thank you," and he looked in his pocket and found 10 cents. "No, no," the young girl said, "I don't want any money. I give it to you with goodwill." "Pardon, madame," said the soldier, "you must know that a German soldier is forbidden to take anything without paying for it." And before that, One-Eyed David had talked at Noyon with a barber whose brother was an aviator with the French army. "My brother," the barber said to me, "told me a beautiful story the other day. He was flying over the lines, and he was amazed one day to see that the French guns were not firing on the Boches, but on the French themselves. He landed precipitously, sprang from his machine, and ran to the office of the general. He saluted and cried in great excitement, 'General, you are firing on the French.' The general regarded him without interest, without budging. Then he said very simply, 'They have begun, they must finish.' Which is why, perhaps," said One-Eyed David, looking two ways at once with his uncorrelated eyes, "the Germans entered Noyon. But to return to Mexico. One night we had a soiree, as David called it, apropos a pot of hot tea which David's wife had given him to take upstairs, it being damnably damp and cold as usual in the enormous room. David, cautiously and in a low voice, invited us to his mattress to enjoy his extraordinary pleasure, and we accepted, B and I, with huge joy, and sitting on David's palais we found somebody who turned out to be Mexicu, to whom, by his right name, our host introduced us with all the poise, and courtesy, vulgarly associated with a French salon. For Mexique I cherish and always will cherish unmitigated affection. He was perhaps 19 years old, very chubby, extremely good-natured, and possessed of an unruffled disposition which extended to the most violent and obvious discomforts a subtle and placid illumination. He spoke beautiful Spanish, had been born in Mexico, and was really called Philippe Burgos. He had been in New York. He criticized someone for saying yes to us one day, stating that no American said yes, but ya, which, whatever the reader may think, is to my mind a very profound observation. In New York, he had worked nights as a fireman in some big building or other, and slept days, and this method of seeing America he had enjoyed extremely. Mexico had one day taken ship, being curious to see the world, and worked as a chauffeur, that is to say, in the stokehole. He had landed in, I think, Havre, had missed his ship, had inquired something of a gendarme in French, which he spoke not at all, with the exception of a phrase or two like quel huo quil est, had been kindly treated and told that he would be taken to a ship de suite, had boarded a train in the company of 2 or 3 kind gendarmes, ridden of prodigious distance, got off the train, finally with high hopes, walked a little distance, come inside of a grey, perspiring wall of La Ferte, and, so I ask one of them, "Where is the ship?" He point to here and tell me, "There is the ship." I say, "This is a goddamn funny ship," quoth Mexicu, laughing. Excuse me. Mexico played dominoes with us, B, having devised a set from cardboard, strolled the enormous room with us, telling of his father and brother in Mexico, of the people, of the customs, and when we were in the corps, wrote the entire conjugation of tengo in the deep mud, with a little stick, squatting and chuckling and explaining. He and his brother had both participated in the revolution which made Carranza president. His description of which affair was utterly delightful. Everybody run around with guns, Mexico said, and by, no see to shoot everybody, so everybody go home. We asked if he had shot anybody himself. Sure, I shoot everybody. I don't know, Mexico answered, laughing. I think everybody no hit me, he added, regarding his stocky person with great and quiet amusement. When we asked him once what he thought about the war, he replied, I think lot of bull. Shit, which, upon copious reflection, I decided absolutely expressed my own point of view. Mexico was generous, incapable of either stupidity or despondency, and mannered as a gentleman is supposed to be. Upon his arrival, he wrote almost immediately to the Mexican, or is it Spanish, consul, he know my father in Mexico, stating in perfect and unambiguous Spanish the facts leading to his arrest. And when I said goodbye to Le Misere, Mexico was expecting a favourable reply at any moment, as indeed he had been cheerfully expecting for some time. If he reads this history, I hope he will not be too angry with me for whatever injustice it does to one of the altogether pleasantest companions I have ever had. My notebooks, one in particular, are covered with conjugations which bear witness to Mexico's ineffable good nature. I also have a somewhat superficial portrait of his back sitting on a bench by the stove. I wish I had another of Mexico out in La Jardin, with a man who worked there who was a Spaniard, and whom the surveillant had considerately allowed Mexico to assist with the perfectly correct idea that it would be pleasant for Mexico to talk to someone who could speak Spanish. If not as well as he, Mexico could at least passably well. As it is, I must be content to see my very good friend sitting with his hands in his pockets by the stove, with Bill the Hollander beside him. And I hope it was not many days after my departure that Mexico went free. Somehow I feel that he went free, and if I am right, I will only say about Mexico's freedom what I have heard him slowly and placidly say many times concerning not only the troubles which were common property to us all, but his own peculiar troubles as well. That's fine. Here let me introduce the guard Champetre, whose name I have hardly taken more or less in vain. A little, sharp, hungry-looking person who, subsequently to being a member of a rural police force, of which membership he seemed rather proud, had served his patrie, otherwise known as La Belle Quique, in the capacity of a motorcyclist. As he carried dispatches from one end of the line to the other, his disagreeably big eyes had absorbed certain peculiarly inspiring details of civilized warfare. He had at one time seen a bridge hastily constructed by Les Allies over the Yessa River, the cadavers of the faithful and the enemy alike being thrown in helter-skelter to make a much-needed foundation for the timbers. This little procedure had considerably outraged the guard Champetri's sense of decency. The Yessa, said he, flowed perfectly red for a long time. We were altogether Belgians, French, English. We Belgians did not see any good reason for continuing the battle, but we continued. Oh, indeed, we continued. Do you know why? I said that I was afraid I didn't. Because in front of us we had the German shells, behind the French machine guns, always the French machine guns, mon vieux. Je ne comprends pas bien, I said in confusion, recalling all the highfalutin rigmarole which Americans believed, little martyred Belgium, protected by the Allies from the inroads of the aggressor, etc. Why should the French put machine guns behind you? The guard Champetre lifted his big empty eyes nervously, the vast hollows in which they lived darkened. His little, rather hard face trembled within itself. I thought for a second he was going to throw a fit at my feet, instead of doing which he replied pettishly, in a sunken, bright whisper, to keep us going forward. At times a company would drop its guns and turn to run. Pop, 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 pop. His short, unlovely arms described gently the swinging of a mitrailleuse. Finish, the Belgian soldiers to left and right of them took the hint. If they did not, pop, 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 pop. Oh, we went forward, yes. Viva le patriotisme. And he rose with a gesture, which seemed to brush away these painful trifles from his memory, crossed the end of the room with short, rapid steps, and began talking to his best friend, Judas, who was at that moment engaged in training his wobbly mustachios. Towards the close of my visit to La Ferté, the garde champêtre was really happy for a period of 2 days, during which time he moved in the society of a rich, intelligent, mistakenly arrested and completely disagreeable youth, in bone spectacles, copious hair and spiral puties, whom B and I partially contented ourselves by naming Jojo the lion-faced boy. Had the charges against Jojo been stronger, my tale would have been longer. Fortunately for Toulamon, they had no basis, and back went Jojo to his native Paris, leaving the guard champêtre with Judas and attacks of only occasionally interesting despair. The reader may suppose that it is about time another delectable mountain appeared upon his horizon. Let him keep his eyes wide open, for here one comes. Whenever our circle was about to be increased, a bell from somewhere afar, as a matter of fact the gate which had admitted my weary self to La Ferté upon a memorable night, as always had been faithfully recounted, tangibly, tanged audibly, whereat up jumped the more strenuous inhabitants of the enormous room, and made pell-mell for the common peephole situated at the door end or nearer end of our habitat, and commanding a somewhat fragmentary view of the gate, together with the arrivals, male and female, whom the bell announced. In one particular case, the watchers appeared almost unduly excited, shouting, 4, big box, 5 gendarmes, and other incoherences with a loudness which predicated great things. As nearly always, I had declined to participate in the melee, and was still lying comfortably horizontal on my bed, thanking God that it had been well and thoroughly mended by a fellow prisoner whom we called the Frog and Le Coiffeur, a tremendously keen-eyed man with a large drooping moustache, whose boon companion, chiefly on account of his shape and gait, we knew as the Lobster. When the usual noises attendant upon the unlocking of the door began with exceptional violence, I sat up, the door shot open. There was a moment's pause, a series of grunting remarks uttered by two rather terrible voices. Then in came the four neveux of a decidedly interesting appearance. They entered in 2 ranks of 2 each. The front rank was made up of an immensely broad soldier's broad-shouldered, hipless, and consequently triangular man in blue trousers, belted with a piece of ordinary rope, plus a thick-set ruffianly personage, the most prominent part of whose accoutrements were a pair of hideous whiskers. I leaped to my feet and made for the door, thrilled in spite of myself by the, in this case, shifty blue eyes, the pallid hair, the well-knit form of the rope's owner I knew instantly, a Hollander, by the coarse, brutal features half hidden in the piratical whiskers, as well as by the heavy mean wandering eyes, I recognized with equal speed a Belgian. Upon his shoulders, the front rank bore a large box, blackish, well-made, obviously very weighty, which box is set down with a grunt of relief hard by the cabinet. The rear rank marched behind in a somewhat asymmetrical manner, a young, stupid-looking, clear-complexioned fellow, obviously a farmer, and having expensive black puties and a handsome cap with a shiny black leather visor. Slightly preceded a tall, gliding, thinnish, unjudgeable personage, who peeped at everyone quietly and solemnly from beneath the visor of a somewhat large, slovenly cloth cap, showing portions of a lean, long, incognizable face, upon which sat, or rather drooped, a pair of mustachios identical in character with those which are sometimes pictorially attributed to a Chinese dignitary. In other words, the mustachios were exquisitely narrow, homogeneously downward, and made of something like black corn silk. Behind Les Neveux staggered 4 pilets, motivated mysteriously by 2 pair of small legs, belonging, as it proved, to Garibaldi and the little machine fixer who, coincidentally with the tumbling of the mattresses to the floor, perspiringly emerged to sight. The first thing the shifty-eyed Hollander did was to exclaim, "Gut verdummer." The first thing the whiskey Belgian did was to grab his pelisse and stand guard over it. The first thing the youth in the leggings did was to stare helplessly about him, murmuring something whimperingly in Polish. The first thing the fourth of Nauvoo did was to pay attention to anybody, lighting a cigarette in an unhurried manner as he did so, and puffing silently and slowly as if in all the universe nothing whatever, save the taste of tobacco, existed. A bevy of Hollanders were by this time about the triangle, asking him all at once, was he from so-and-so, what was in his box, how long had he been in coming, etc. Half a dozen stooped over the box itself, and at least three pairs of hands were on the point of trying the lock, when suddenly, with incredible agility, the unperturbed smoker shot a yard forward, landed quietly beside them, and exclaimed rapidly and briefly through his nose, "Mang." He said it almost petulantly, as a child says, "Tag, you're it." The onlookers recoiled, completely surprised, whereat the frightened youth in black puttees sidled over and explained with a pathetic, at once ingratiating and patronizing accent, "Hey, he is not nasty, he is a good fellow, he is my friend, he wants to say that it's his, that box. He doesn't speak French." "It's the Gutverdummer Polak's box," said the triangular man, exploding in Dutch. "They're a pair of Polakers, and this man," with a twist of his pale blue eyes in the direction of the bewhiskered one, "and I had to carry it all the Gutdummer way to this Gutdummer place." All this time the incognizable Nauvoo was smoking slowly and calmly, and looking at nothing at all with his black button-like eyes. Upon his face no faintest suggestion of expression could be discovered by the hungry minds, which focused unanimously upon its almost stern contours. The deep furrows in the cardboard-like cheeks, furrows which resembled slightly the gills of some extraordinary fish, some unbreathing fish, moved not an atom. The moustache drooped in something like mechanical tranquillity, the lips closed occasionally with a gesture at once abstracted and sensitive upon the lightly and carefully held cigarette, whose curling smoke accentuated the poise of the head, at once alert and uninterested. Monsieur Auguste broke in, speaking, as I thought, Russian, and in an instant he and the youth in puttees and the unknowable's cigarette and the box and the unknowable had disappeared through the crowd in the direction of Monsieur Auguste's palais, which was also the direction of the palais belonging to the cordonnier, as he was sometimes called, a diminutive man with immense mustachios of his own, who promenaded with Monsieur Auguste, speaking sometimes French, but, as a general rule, Russian or Polish. Which was my first glimpse, and is the reader's, of the Zulu, he being one of the Delectable Mountains, for which I shall have more to say of him later. When I ascend the Delectable Mountains in a separate chapter or chapters, till when the reader must be content with the above, however unsatisfactory, description, one of the most utterly repulsive personages whom I have met in my life, perhaps, and on second thought I think certainly, the most utterly repulsive, was shortly after this presented to our midst by the considerate French government. I refer to the fighting Sheeny. Whether or not he arrived after the Spanish hallmaster I cannot say. I remember that Bill the Hollander, which was the name of the triangular rope-belted man with shifty blue eyes, co-arrive with the whiskey Belgian, which Belgian, by the way, from his not-to-be-exaggerated brutal look, B and myself called the baby snatcher. Upon his arrival told great tales of a Spanish millionaire, of whom he had been in prison just previous to his discovery of La Ferté. "He'll be here, too, in a couple of days," added Bill the Hollander, who had been 14 years in these United States, spoke the language to a T, talked about the America Lakes, and was otherwise amazingly well acquainted with the land of the free. And sure enough, in less than a week, one of the fattest men whom I have ever laid eyes on, dressed, overdressed, much beringed, and otherwise wealthy-looking, arrived and was immediately played up to by Judas, who could smell cash almost as far as the gouvernement français could smell sedition. And to my somewhat surprise by the utterly respectable Count Braggart, but most emphatically not by Mexique, who spent a half hour talking to the Nauvoo in his own tongue, then drifted placidly over to our beds and informed us, "You see dat fella over dere, dat fat fella, I speak Spanish to him, he no good. He tell me he make 50,000 franc last year running whorehouse in, I think it was, Brest, son of bitch. That fat fella lived in a perfectly huge bed, which he contrived to have brought up for him immediately upon his arrival. The bed arrived in a knockdown state, and with it a mechanician from a Laville, who set about putting it together, meanwhile indulging in many glances expressive not merely of interest but of amazement and even fear. I suppose the bed had to be a special size in order to accommodate the circular millionaire, and being an extraordinary bed required the services of a skilled artisan. At all events, dat fat fella's couch put the skippers altogether in the shade. As I watched the process of construction, it occurred to me that after all, here was the last word in luxury. To call forth from the metropolis not only a special divan, but with it a special slave, the slave of the bed, dat fat fella had one of the prisoners perform his corvée for him. Dat fat fella bought enough at the canteen twice every day to stock a transatlantic liner for 7 voyages, and never ace with the prisoners. I will mention him again apropos, the Mecca of respectability, the great white throne of purity, 3 rings, 3, alias Count Braggard, to whom I have long since introduced my reader. So we come willy-nilly to the Fighting Sheeny. The Fighting Sheeny arrived carrying the expensive suitcase of a livid, strangely unpleasant-looking Romanian gent who wore a knit sweater of a strangely ugly red hue, impeccable clothes, and an immaculate velour hat, which must have been worth easily 50 francs. We called this gent Rocky Fella. His personality might be faintly indicated by the adjective disagreeable. The porter was a creature whom ugly does not even slightly describe. There are some specimens of humanity in whose presence one instantly and instinctively feels a profound revulsion, a revulsion which, perhaps because it is profound, cannot be analysed. The Fighting Sheeny was one of these specimens. His face, or to use the good American idiom, his mug, was exceedingly coarse-featured and had an indefatigable expression of sheer brutality, yet the impression which it gave could not be traced to any particular plane or line. I can and will say, however, that this face was most hideous. Perhaps that is the word. When the Fighting Sheeny grinned, you felt that he desired to eat you, and he was prevented from eating you only by a superior desire to eat everybody at once. He and Rocky Fella came to us from, I think it was, the Sante, both accompanied B to Presigny. During the weeks which the Fighting Sheeny spent at La Ferté Macé, the non-existent of the inhabitants of the enormous room was rendered something more than miserable. It was rendered well nigh unbearable. The night Rocky Fella and his slave arrived was a night to be remembered by everyone. It was one of the wildest and strangest and most perfectly interesting nights I, for one, ever spent. Rocky Fella had been corralled by Judas, and was enjoying a special bed to our right at the upper end of the enormous room. At the canteen he had purchased a large number of candles in addition to a great assortment of dainties, which he and Judas were busily enjoying. When the planton came up, counted us twice, divided by 3, gave the order Lumieres Estientes, and ascended, locking the door behind him. Everyone composed himself for miserable sleep, everyone except Judas, who went on talking to Rocky Fella, and Rocky Fella, who proceeded to light one of his candles and begin a pleasant and conversational evening. The Fighting Sheeny lay stark naked on a palliasse between me and his lord. The Fighting Sheeny told everybody that to sleep stark naked was to avoid bugs, whereof everybody, including myself, had a goodly portion. The Fighting Sheeny was, however, quieted by the planton's order, whereas Rocky Fella continued to talk and munch to his heart's content. This began to get on everybody's nerves. Protests in a number of languages arose from all parts of the enormous room. Rocky Fella gave contemptuous looks around him and proceeded with his conversation. A curse emanated from the darkness. Up sprang the Fighting Sheeny, stark naked, strode over to the bed and the cursor, and demanded furiously, "Box vu." The cursor was apparently fast asleep and even snoring. The Fighting Sheeny turned away disappointed and had just reached his palais when he was greeted by a number of uproariously discourteous remarks uttered in all sorts of tongues. Over he rushed, threatened, received no response and turned back to his place. Once more 10 or 12 voices insulted him from the darkness. Once more the fighting sheen he made for them, only to find sleeping innocence. Again he tried to go to bed. Again the shouts arose, this time with redoubled violence and in a greatly increased number. The fighting sheeny was at his wit's end. He strode about challenging everyone to a fight, receiving not the slightest recognition, cursing, reviling, threatening, bullying. The darkness always awaited for him to resume his mattress, then burst out in all sorts of maledictions upon his head and the sacred head of his lord and master. The latter was told to put out his candle and go to sleep and give the rest a chance to enjoy what pleasure they might in forgetfulness of their woes. Whereupon he appealed to the sheeny to stop this. The sheeny, almost weeping, said he had done his best, that everyone was a pig, that nobody would fight, that it was disgusting. Roars of applause, protests from the less strenuous members of our circle against the noise in general, let him have his futu candle, shut up and go to sleep yourself, etc. Rockefeller kept on talking, albeit visibly annoyed by the ill-breeding of his fellow captives, to the smooth and oily Judas. The noise, or rather noises, increased. I was for some reason angry at Rockefeller. I think I had a curious notion that if I couldn't have a light after Lumiere's etiences, and if my very good friends were none of them allowed to have one, then by God neither should Rockefeller. At any rate, I passed a few remarks calculated to wither by this time a little nervous Übermensch, got up, put on some enormous sabots, which I had purchased from a horrid little boy whom the French government had arrested with his parents for some cause unknown, with which horrid little boy told me that he had found the sabots in a train on the way to La Ferté, shook myself into my fur coat, and banged a noise-makingly as I knew how over to One-Eyed David's Palais, where Mexique joined us. It is useless to sleep, said One-Eyed David in French and Spanish. True, I agreed. Therefore, let's make all the noise we can. Steadily the racket bulged in the darkness. Human cries, quips, and profanity had now given place to wholly inspired imitations of various, not to say sundry, animals. A freak exclaimed with great pleasure. I recognized his voice through the impenetrable gloom. Ah-ga-ga-ga-ga-ga-ga-ga-ga-ga-ga. Perhaps, said I, he means a machine gun. It sounds like either that or a monkey. The wanderer crowded beautifully. Monsieur Auguste's bosom friend Le Cordonnier uttered an astonishing meow, which provoked a tornado of laughter and some applause. Mooings, chirpings, cacklings, there was a superb hen, neighings, hee-hawing, roarings, bleatings, growlings, quackings, peepings, screamings, bellowings, and something else, of course, set the enormous room suddenly and entirely alive. Never have I imagined such a menagerie as had magically instated itself within the erstwhile soggy and dismal four walls of our chamber. Even such staid characters as Count Braggart set up a little bawling. Monsieur Pet Ayres uttered a tiny aged crowing to my immense astonishment and delight. The dying, the sick, the ancient, the mutilated made their contributions to the common pandemonium, and then from the lower left darkness sprouted one of the very finest noises which ever fell on human ears, the noise of a little dog with floppy ears who was tearing after something on very short legs and carrying his very fuzzy tail straight up in the air as he tore, a little dog who was busier than he was wise, louder than he was big, a red-tongued, foolish, breathless, intent little dog with black eyes and a great smile and woolly paws, which noise, conceived and executed by the lobster, sent the enormous room into an absolute and incurable hysteria. All right, there we go. I'm going to end it at that point. We'll see how the fighting sheeny reacts to this pandemonium tomorrow. Thank you very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.